Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 13 of NML Crossing, also known as Remedial Theoretical Geology. Today we're back to the flagship, and, I'm reading from a bullet-pointed Google Doc that took me forever to put together. Actually, forever to pare down. A lot of non-comics research fun here, and, you know, if you've listened to anything that I've done, you'll know that I have a habit or penchant of trying to integrate whatever little, I don't know, little bits of knowledge, little bits of weird science and philosophy into our coverage here. I think the last time I engaged in something like this was probably during the Immortal X-Men number 1 episode of X-Lapsed, where the cover of that book is, I guess, an homage to the painting of the Last Supper, the Last Supper of Christ. And there were a lot of very fun parallels that could be drawn, and it led to a lot of research about that painting. And it was really fun research to perform because I was able to draw some parallels to the characters and even theorize what some of their behaviors and motivations were going to be based on who they were mirroring in the painting. And today is, it's not quite that in-depth, but we're going to be getting some nuggets of information from Batman and some other folks that, it inspired me to do some, off-comics research. And as I tend to do, I went, headfirst into this research that has something to do with the story, but it's not the be-all, end-all of the story by any means. It's really just I don't know if MacGuffin's the right word for it, but it's like a thing to move the story forward. It's a thing to give a realization that we're zigging instead of zagging. It's proof positive that something is not quite right. It's all based on this little info dump that we get. But, as I'm wont to do, I did a lot of that research, and before I knew it, this Google Doc was at like 24 pages, which nobody needs me talking for 24 pages. And I mean, at this point, when I was doing the research, I don't even think I was at the staples of the book yet. So that wouldn't have even been near me, wrapping up the episode. So I pared down. I did a lot of editing, a lot of information that I found interesting, taken out because it was too much. Like, this wasn't just Wikipedia stuff. This was like a theory that was positive, arguments for and against. And the theory is interesting in that at first blush, it sounds sound, like it sounds scientifically sound. But then it gets into some like weird mythological stuff while still trying to maintain the scientific integrity. We'll get to it. I think I'm probably putting the cart before the horse here. All that to say, this could have been a very, very long episode and a very, very, a more boring than usual episode. So thank goodness I had the foresight to engage in a lot of editing. But with that out of the way, how about we hop into today's book, which is Batman number 554, which had a May 1998 cover date. The story is called Cataclysm Part 12, Master of Destruction. Writer Doug Mensch, pencils Klaus Janson, inks Sal Buscema, colors Gregory Wright and Android Images, letters Todd Klein, edits Gorfinkel O'Neill, cover price $1.95. Now we pick up right where we left off at the end of Nightwing number 20. Well, maybe a page or two before the end of it. We see Detective Hawk changing into his night shift uniform, which is to say the bat suit. Now he listens in on Gordon, Montoya, and Bullock as they view the Quakemaster tape. I didn't realize during the last pages of Nightwing that it was Montoya and Bullock with Gordon. I probably was just glossing over it. I don't know. Now, on the tape, the Big Bad explains that there's no stopping him. There's no way to save the city, no hope of anything, unless the city hands him over a hundo mil in cash. After stopping the tape, the GCPDers discuss whether or not this is legit, or if it's even something they want to mess with. We find out here that the Quakemaster used electronic distortion to disguise his or her voice, so at this point there's no way of tracking them down from how they sound. By now, Batman's already taken off. After all, he does have a Seismo hookup in our old new friend Jolene Relazzo. We get a couple pages of our hero saving some civilians while heading toward a phone booth. And, I won't do that thing where I pretend to introduce, you know, the kids these days to the phenomenon that was phone booths. On that thought, Batman decides to check, the phone book that's at this phone booth. You see, kids, phone books were... Never mind. Anyway, he lets his bat fingers do the walking until he happens across the address for Relazzo, J. Now, she lives at 327 Mercator, in case you want to add her to your Christmas card list. Thing of it is, gang, we already know she ain't home, right? We saw her get abducted by some goons. When was it? Shadow of the Bat? Episode 10? A little while ago? Anyway... She's done been snatched, and we will now find out who done it, or who orchestrated it. We already know that it was Moe and Dunk that took her. Anyway, it was the Doi, the Quakemaster. We see Jolene, who's been tied to a chair. Old QM wants to get some, I guess, technical seismo-what's-it jargon out of her. You see, he needs to sound knowledgeable on all things quakey, which... Yeah, I guess that stands to reason if he's going to portray himself as some sort of master of them, right? It's perhaps worth noting here, the Quakemaster is very much in his, like, John Henry Iron Steel-like form right now. I think it was last episode, or maybe the one before, where I discussed the odd design for the Quakemaster and how it's, like, this ever-shifting nebulous, sort of like the Kingpin... Sort of like the robot that Krang was in Ninja Turtles. He's very, very bizarre looking. And the artists that we have for this run so far are, I don't know, distinctive in their own way. Like, I flipped through the trade collection and it doesn't flow. sometimes art flows between artists. Sometimes it does not. And this is a case where it really does not. We go from Scott McDaniel's art to Klaus Janson, inked by Sal Buscema art. It's very, very different. Anyway, the gimmick here is that if Jolene doesn't make with the info, he's gonna kill her. Duh. So she tells him that if he talks about something called crustal displacement, it would surely convince the people and the decision makers of Gotham that he knows what he's talking about. And, you know, that he can make good on his threat. So, I guess the Quakemaster's a fraud. Huh. More on that later. But first, well, you might be wondering, what in the hell is crustal displacement? Well, let's do some abridged discussion on that. Heavily abridged. And while I could save this for later on in the issue where Batman himself gives a brief explanation on it, I did do a little bit of research on it myself. And as mentioned, probably way too much research, which bore relatively little fruit, largely because I'm an idiot. Anyway, it's a theory, or a pseudoscientific claim, which is also known as the cataclysmic pole shift hypothesis. And it's seismo-what's-its, but it's not connected to plate tectonics. It's interesting. Not plate tectonics, but as the name suggests, it's related to the poles. Things like ice ages and changes in climate, it's posited, can be attributed to sudden shifts of the geographic poles due to this displacement. Now, the original theory was put forward by Charles Hapgood. He speculated that accumulated polar ice actually destabilizes the Earth's rotation, and he had a book called The Earth's Shifting Crust, published in 1958. And he wasn't some crackpot. I mean, the book had a foreword written by Albert Einstein. And Einstein says, quote, "In a polar region, there's a continual disposition of ice, which is not symmetrically distributed about the pole. The Earth's rotation acts on these unsymmetrically deposited masses and produces centrifugal, however you say that word, momentum that is transmitted to the rigid crust of the Earth. The constantly increasing centrifugal momentum produced this way will, when it reaches a certain point, produce movement of the Earth's crust over the rest of the Earth's body, and this will displace the polar regions toward the equator. Pretty interesting stuff. Now, Hapgood would encourage a Canadian librarian named Reed Flem-Ath, Flem-Ath, he was born Reed Fleming, to write about this theory, and boy, did he. His work would attempt to tie crustal displacement to the lost continent of Atlantis, which, well, we'll mention that again later, since this is the DC universe that our story is happening in. Anyway, Reed Flem-Ath's theory is that around every 41,000 years, a catastrophic shifting of the Earth's entire crust occurs. The last one would have occurred about 11,600 years ago, which resulted in a displacement of 3,000 kilometers and a 30-degree change to Earth's rotation. It's during this shift, he suggests, that Atlantis shifted toward the South Pole. Now, he's suggesting that Atlantis would eventually become the continent we know as Antarctica, or be buried below the ice and snow that is Antarctica, I guess. It's really some trippy reading, and I went on for a long time with fours and againsts, and I don't know, this sort of stuff just tickles me. It's very, very interesting, even as, you know, speculative food for thought. But we'll end it here. This is enough for what we're getting into here. Anyway, let's rejoin Batman as he enters Jolene's apartment window, and, well, duh, she ain't home. He turns on her radio and hears a broadcast from Vesper Fairchild, a woman with whom Bruce Wayne had a bit of a romantic entanglement, and I suppose, if nothing else, this scene does add her to our No Man's Land chessboard. Batman then takes a look around the apartment to see if he can suss anything out. He notes that the door was definitely busted in, but there are no signs of struggle or looting. Outside in the hallway, he's able to make out some footprints in the dust. Two sets of dude-looking prints, then a third, smaller set of paws that made it look like their owner was being dragged away. Batman briefly considers that this whole thing might have been set up to appear as though it was an abduction, and he starts to wonder to himself if perhaps Jolene Relazzo might just be our Quake Master. I mean, who knows more about Gotham's tectonic whatever the hell than Jolene, right? Maybe. Next stop, the Wayne Corp building, where Lucius, who I keep typing in my notes as Luscious Fox, is trying to get food and housing sorted for the many, 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 many displaced Gothamites. Just then, Bruce Wayne saunters up. And, well, I kind of brushed up against the art here, but I haven't really gone into detail. And you guys know I don't like going into art anyway, but Bruce looks about to be as wide as he is tall here. The art overall gives this book a very, very dated feel. Kind of feels like a fill-in, or the third story we'd get in an early 90s Marvel annual, or something that would pop up in a quarterly anthology. It just feels off. Anyway, now Bruce is there to see if he can get any more information on Jojo Relazzo. Lucius informs him that the computers are down, duh, but they probably have some hard copy backups that he can flip through. And so we follow them up 9 flights of stairs to the personnel office to dig up that data. While this scene plays out, we pop in on Harvey and Renee, who are watching some more of the Quakemaster Manifesto. In it, he mentions crustal displacement. So I suppose that Relazzo scene a few pages back might have taken place in Flashback Land? I don't know, maybe not. Perhaps he just wanted reassurance or something. Doesn't matter. All we know is she said crustal displacement, he said crustal displacement. It's out there. From here, we jump over to the Batcave. Now, Robin, he's kind of woe-is-me-ing over this being the end of Batman. Alfred tells him to hush his mouth, because Goon or Bat family members never say die. Off to the side, we see that Harold is already hard at work writing up plans to rebuild. At least I think so. I mean, he's writing something. I'm going to assume they're plans. Over to the GCPD HQ, where Batman meets up with Jim Gordon and a big old bag of shredded newspaper. You see, they're trying to buy time here. They've already agreed to the Quake Master's terms and are hoping that this bag of paper, in lieu of the hundo mill and cash, might help them stall a little bit. Batman takes the sack and a copy of the QM Manifesto and heads over to the drop-off point, which is at the end of the Quake Causeway. Before leaving, Batman does ask if Jim heard anything from his wife, Sarah Essen, and a slump-shouldered Gordon admits that he has not. We follow Batman to Coit, where he drops the sack. Moments later, a helicopter appears, which is piloted by our pals Mo and Dunk. I don't know how these guys can tie their shoes, much less pilot a helicopter, but what are you gonna do? Anyway, they winch down a hook, and they snag the dough. Batman hops on the line and climbs up to the undercarriage of the chopper, which they notice there's added weight, but don't think much of it. They land on a rooftop somewhere nearby and are immediately beaten up by the Bat. And, we get around 3 pages of biff-bam-boom before the baddies cry uncle. When asked about their big boss, they admit that they've never actually seen the Quake Master in full light. Dunk goes on to suggest that there might actually be 2 Quake Masters. Batman, following up on his Relazzo theory, asks if one of them might be a woman. But the goons don't know, since only one of them ever spoke, and again, they were in, like, total darkness, or at least obscured view, so neither of them got a good look at either of them. They share that this whole mishigas started when they received a note to meet their boss, who turned out to be the Quake Master, at the GCTV studio. Now, Batman asked if the note was left at their homes, and yeah, it was. So, it looks like we got us a new lead. This Quake Master is most likely someone that Mo and Dunk already knew. Stands to reason, right? Well, not to Mo and Dunk, who hadn't considered that possibility at all. Anyway, during this dialogue, it looks like someone came and snagged that bag of newspaper. Let's hop back to Montoya and Bullock, who are having yet another rewatch of the tape. This time around, Renee notices something and is able to deduce that these video missives were recorded at the GCTV studio. And so, 2 panels later, she and Harv bust in on the place, only to find it completely abandoned. Well, okay, not completely. Not completely. There's no Quake Master there, but Batman's there. And he's got Mo and Dunk, who he hands over to the detectives. He tells the techs to interrogate these idiots and interrogate them hard. Also, to comb their rap sheets for all of their known criminal associates, since one of them is probably our guy. From here, we return to the Batcave for... A very, very, very underwhelming Bat Family reunion. Like, Batman's just here now. He's just there. Nobody looks excited, nobody looks happy, nobody looks relieved. It's just like, oh, there's Batman. In fairness, it does look like Harold did get his hair done for the occasion. It looks like he got a perm or something. Like I said, the art is a bit sketchy. Now that he's back, Batman reveals everything that he now knows. And Dick is a bit taken aback to learn that there's actually somebody out there claiming credit for the Quake. Alfred and Harold set up a console so the heroes can watch the Quake Master Manifesto tape. And no sooner does Batman hear the words, "crustal displacement," than he asks Alfred to turn it off. You see, in his mind, this clears Jolene Relazzo of being the Quake Master. And he also suggests that the very inclusion of this theory is something of a message Jojo is trying to send. In addition, it tells Batman that this Quake Master likely isn't behind the very bad thing that happened at 703, and is simply trying to profit by making this empty threat. To which Dick's all, "splain, Brucey." And so Batman gives his TED talk on crustal displacement. He pretty much cites the same research I did earlier, with added bits about how sudden the theoretical shifting actually occurred. The evidence has to do with the belly contents of woolly mammoths that had been dug out of the ice. Now, the perfectly preserved food in their bellies, plants and whatnot, would grow only in warmer climates. And, well, mammoths and ice suggests something a little chillier, right? So going by that, we would have to assume that this displacement was... if not instantaneous, very, very quick, right? So quick that the mammoths, and there were also rhinos who were studied, their stomachs couldn't digest the food. that's how quickly it happened. There's a lot of discussion, a lot of interesting discussion, a lot of silly discussion about this that I did go into, but I decided to omit because I'd basically just be talking myself in circles. So we'll just go with what Batman says here and let that be good enough. Now, they talk a little bit about Antarctica having been Atlantis, which, okay, cards on the table. I'm no Aquaman expert, but don't we already have one of those? I don't know, like Dick saying, quote, if Atlantis ever really existed, dot, dot, dot. Like, isn't Dick pals with Aqualad? Doesn't he live in Atlantis? Is it a different, I really don't know. Anyway, Batman says here that the crustal displacement line was almost definitely fed to the clueless Quake Master by Jolene. He cites how Jolene actually used that same theory in order to convince Bruce Wayne of the possibility of the very quake we just experienced. And so we close out this issue with the realization that even if the Quake Master isn't, you know, a cataclysmic, catastrophic level threat, he's still a bad dude. And he currently holds the life of Jolene Relazzo in his hands. Next episode. Well, the blurb says Detective Comics number 721, but it's actually our second one-shot. Huntress, Spoiler, Blunt Trauma. Or was it Spoiler, Huntress, Blunt Trauma? I guess we'll worry about the Indicia nonsense next time. For now, let's talk about this one, which this was a really interesting chapter. The crustal displacement tangent was quite unexpected. And a welcome little aside, right? This kind of transcended the, you know, supervillain, superhero sort of dynamic and introduced something theoretically real world. I mean, mileage may vary, of course, on the theory, but it was interesting. It was a nice little rabbit hole to go down, and I really enjoyed the research bait. But part of me has to be fair with my analysis here. And this might just be me being cynical me, but back during other projects like X-Lapsed, I would always kind of point out when it was obvious that a writer just learned something they found interesting and decided to immediately shoehorn it into their next script. And I mean, I sometimes consider myself to be a writer. A bad one, yeah, but in the most basic sense, a writer, you know, someone who puts words on paper. And I know that I am definitely guilty of this. If I find out something interesting that I think I can parlay into a story, well, damn it, I'm going to do that, usually to the detriment of the story, because I'm not a very good writer. I can't say that this bit with the crustal displacement doesn't feel kind of like that. Sure, I mean, it's Seismo, what's it theory, so it fits, and it, like, helps the story move forward. But I don't know, still, something about it felt a little precious. Maybe it was, you know, using theoretical real-world stuff in the fantastical DC universe, talking about, like, whether or not Atlantis really ever existed when we have one. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure I'm probably thinking way too hard about it, but, in any event, I do like this. I do like the revelation that the Quake Master is full of it and the way we got around to it. I mean, it was a clever, though kind of convenient, way to bring that about. Let me try and explain here. In any other comic, when someone knows something, it's usually rooted in, like, I don't know, their history and just what they know and their experiences. With Batman, it's different. You know, we complain, or at least I complain, that nowadays, and for probably for the past 20-some-odd years, Batman is always presented as the smartest person in whatever room he dare enter. This gave me a little bit of that. Definitely not to the levels it would eventually get to, but it's just like, I don't know, it feels like, you know, anytime any, like, $100 word comes up, everybody's automatically looking at Batman to get the explanation for what this word might mean for the, you know, next leg of the story. Again, I'm sure I'm thinking too hard and being way too cynical on something that doesn't deserve my cynicism. Now, speaking of the geologic bat lecture, how underdamn whelming was that Bat Family reunion. Like, really? I mean, at this point, we've had over 10 chapters, 10 entire issues, where the Bat Family were scattered. You know, not only that, the big guy was displaced, missing, and feared dead. And this is the reunion we get? Like, I don't need hugs and kisses, but maybe show us Batman entering the damn cave? Like, maybe finishing someone's sentence and then being, like, relieved and happy and just, like, I don't know, glad he's not dead? No, we don't get that. F that. We just get a close-up of Batman's face saying, no time for reunions, lads. It's just so underwhelming and, in my eyes, definitely a missed opportunity because this story is, you know, this whole arc is kind of unique in that it's bigger than good guys, bad guys. You know, there's this survival, hope, displacement, just, there are so many things that feed into human emotion here that we just don't get. And I understand that, you know, there's a time for cooler heads to prevail, and this might be one of those times, but like even Nightwing, like putting his hand on Batman's shoulder saying, I'm glad you're not dead, and Batman saying, I'm glad I'm not dead too, or something like that, or I'm glad you're not dead. Something. And I mean, add to that the sort of, I don't know, lifeless or emotionless art that we get from Jansen and Buscema. It's kind of a miss for me. I mean, overall, it's a good issue, but there were a handful of misses here, unfortunately. Like, sometimes stories need progression, but also sometimes progressions need story. And I feel like this issue is definitely a case of that. You know, we needed to progress, but we can't just write an essay and say everything is moving to the next step. We have to facilitate that. And I feel like this issue, unfairly or not, was kind of left holding the progression bag, you know, for lack of a better term. But, I mean, worth a read, of course. You know, if you're following along, it's vital information in there. But in my opinion, only kind of just, you know, information. But I think that's where I will leave my hard-hitting analysis for today. And we will hop into the NML bag. And we're going to talk to our friend CJ, who left a comment over at the blog, chrisisoninfiniteearths.com, regarding Shadow of the Bat and the Chronicles episodes. Now, CJ says a few thoughts in response to this episode and Monday's Batman Chronicles episode. One, I'm a big fan of the wizard stuff you brought into this episode. I like having the context of how it was viewed, presented, and reported at the time, which is one of the things I liked most about your Claremont to Claremont series. That being said, I don't think you need to or should add a whole bunch of this stuff, just something like a couple minutes per episode at most, like you added here. I'm not sure if you grouped the Denny O'Neill essay from the beginning of this project as the same sort of thing, but I found that to be very interesting and a nice additional focus for the project as a whole. From Claremont to Claremont, perhaps my most ambitious failure yet. For those who don't know, this was, good grief, this was like 4 years ago. Where did my life go? From Claremont to Claremont was a, what I called a clubhouse show. It was a month-by-month look at the X-Men books between the Claremont runs. You know, Claremont left in 91, came back around the turn of the century. That entire, you know, 90s era was my wheelhouse. It's where I came into it, where I discovered the X-Men, where I fell in love with the X-Men, where I became obsessed with the X-Men. And I wanted to do a show that felt, that kind of evoked that sort of feeling with all the gestalt, with all the, you know, the ephemera, all that good stuff that, I don't know, I think it's one of the commonalities we have as comic fans is that we kind of glom on to those, I don't know the exact term for it, but just where we were in life when we discovered certain things. You know, it's something that I'm known to say is that comic fans or fans of any sort of periodical, collectors of periodicals have this weird, like, you know, we have our own linear timeline where we live, but we also have these other linear timelines that kind of track along with our lives. We can mark every single month by what comic book was out. And back before they relaunched everything every 20 minutes, we had these long, long, long runs of comics that could span lifetimes. And I think that's one of the purest commonalities we have as comic book fans. It, you know, doesn't take quality into consideration. It doesn't take taste into consideration. It just takes the love of the comics form and medium and just, I guess, the industry in general. From Claremont to Claremont, like I said, it was a clubhouse show. We covered every single book with an X in the title or X adjacent for every month. And there were only three episodes because it was a massive, like I said, it was an ambitious failure and massive undertaking. And each segment, so each book had its own segment, and each segment had its own co-host. So I was throughout the whole thing. But for every single book, I would have a different co-host talking about that book, which was super, super fun. I mean, it was a wonderfully fun project. I talked to a lot of great people, a lot of friends who I let down by dropping the concept altogether. But it was a good time while it lasted. It was really cool because not only would we talk about the book, but we would talk about things related or tangentially related to the books. So each episode, each segment of each episode was unique, and the conversation could go in any way, and it was just, it felt like a clubhouse, and it was just wonderful, wonderful stuff. And like I said, it was heavily into the gestalt of the 90s X-books and just 90s comics culture altogether. And one of the segments was, you know, a full look at all the X stuff in Wizard Magazine for that month, which was a lot of fun too, because the X books were, of course, the industry leaders back then. So there was a lot of X stuff in Wizard. And in those blurbs and articles and reviews and columns, you could really, I don't know, kind of take the temperature of how the X books were being received, especially in this like weird and nebulous, is Claremont leaving? Is it acrimonious that he's, you know, was it an acrimonious split from Marvel? What's going on here? What are his thoughts on the books now? It was a lot of fun. Definitely a huge regret of mine for letting that kind of fall apart. I mean, each episode, it was a monthly show, and each episode was like 12 to 15 hours long. I mean, it wasn't a small undertaking. Like I said, ambitious failure. So yeah, I mean, all that to say, I love the Wizard Ephemera, and it will continue to be a brief fixture every now and again here on the show when we, you know, again, take the temperature of how these books were being received by the comics journos at the time and, you know, independent reviewers and stuff like that. I think that could be a lot of fun, and it might open my eyes to things that I missed, because, I mean, honestly, I'm kind of coming into this not so much blind, but I guess in a way forgetful blind. Like, these are old books that I haven't thought about in a long, long time. So context is, while context is king of most things, I don't really have all of it. So this is going to be a learning experience all the way throughout. You know, we're kind of working in reverse, which it might be fitting because, I mean, we're going to be doing a lot of Gotham City rebuilding here, and I'm kind of rebuilding my knowledge of these books. So I think it'll be fun to keep doing the Wizard stuff. Of course, I want to keep hearing people's thoughts and suggestions before I, you know, totally go off the rails and start checking, you know, the DC Batbook Usenet posts from the day. Yeah, who knows? As for the Denny essay, I would love to include more of those because I, like CJ said here, that was very, very interesting. You know, just getting, you know, straight from the group editor's mouth here, his thoughts on crossovers, why they went away, why they're coming back, what to expect, what not to expect. I love that information and I would love to include more, but there just haven't been any. It's weird. I mean, we're only, what, that was a March cover date, and now we're in May, so there were no Den from the Den essays in April, and I don't think there are going to be any in May, but Of course, we will play it by ear, and when they show up, we will cover them if they're applicable. CJ continues. He says, I know all too well the comic collecting as addiction metaphor and the impulse to buy things to have them. Not to sell them, but to have them, instead of buying fewer comics that I'm more likely to actually sit down and read. I go through constant cluttering and decluttering cycles, depending on how far into this addiction that I've slipped, and also how much space or money I have. Reggie's series of podcasts on comics collecting he did shortly before he passed explored some of these ideas very well, and were something I related to all too well. Not sure if that's a good thing or not. The Reggie's collecting series was really, really cool in that regard. It was just cool overall. I was actually the first guest on that show. Because, I very much, my name is Chris and I'm, a comic-holic or whatever. I am an addict. And, I go through, I don't go through decluttering cycles. I don't get rid of anything. I just cycle through different levels of addiction, like how much am I hoarding? Or am I willing to leave this behind? Or do I need this even though I'm never going to read it? Like, if I'm in a quarter bin and I find like a 5-issue run of Quasar, it's like, do I need this? And then I think, but it's 5 issues in a row. I could, maybe turn this into something or just have it. And I need it all of a sudden. It's just ridiculous how I can get into things like that. Reggie's show, we were actually looking to take that series to the next level. Written almost like an attempt at like a sort of kind of peer-reviewed sort of thing. The psychology and the behaviors of collectors, comics and otherwise, it's fascinating. It's very, very fascinating. And we wanted to kind of suss out, the intersections of fandom and their addictive tendencies. Looking into whys, hows, the antecedents, just like everything that kind of informs their behavior. And, we had a fair amount of data in a Google Doc we shared, and a lot of shared experiences and commonalities in that research file. And, sure, the sample size was relatively small, or actually quite small, and it was also a very niche sample. Because, we whittled down here. It wasn't just people who collect stuff. It was largely comic book collectors. And then it was largely comic book collectors who listened to comics history podcasts. And then it was comic collectors who listened to comics history podcasts who wanted to share their experiences. So, not the most universal, but kind of universal to folks like us. Because these are our people. These are us. And, they say the best research sometimes is me-search. And it was going to be fun. It was going to be very fun, hopefully eye-opening. But, I still have the file, but it doesn't feel right to pursue it at this point. But I still look at it occasionally, and it's interesting because, like I said, I think you probably couldn't put two comic fans in a room and get them to agree on how to make a pitcher of Kool-Aid. But we do have these commonalities that kind of supersede everything else just by our experience and where we are and what we're passionate about. Very, very fun stuff. CJ, back to CJ. He says, I get your take on anthologies, and I do also agree that they're hit or miss and often less consequential stories. But I like how anthologies give creative teams, maybe even newer creators, the chance to try out an interesting idea without having to commit it to a full comic, especially if the idea is interesting but doesn't have enough legs for a full comic. The experimental nature of this does lead to a lot of misses, agreed, but I like seeing something different. I also get the take that these stories matter less in terms of continuity, but that's more something that bothers me now than it did when I was a kid. When I was a kid, I still liked Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, and X-Men Unlimited, even if I would not put them in my top titles for those families. And yeah, I totally, totally get that. I'm kind of a couple of minds on the anthology format. people who listen to X-Labs, they might remember how hard I actually advocated for the return of something like X-Men Unlimited, back before they did bring it back, and that mostly sucked, but it wasn't my vision for it. I felt like an Unlimited book would have been an efficient kind of catch-all for some of the post-Hoxpox concepts that, in my opinion, and my opinion only matters to me, couldn't carry a title or even a miniseries, because we got a lot of glut. You know, the even to this day, that Hoxpox line is bloated to the gills. I haven't looked at it in ages, but from what I've heard from folks is that it's like pulling the world's longest tooth. It's like it just refuses to stop. It refuses to end, and they keep extending it, and they keep adding to it, and it's just like, I could have sworn I remembered Hickman saying that this was like a year's worth of stories that they've somehow stretched into like a half decade at this point. I don't know. Now, back when I was doing X-Lapsed, and even then, there was a lot of bloat, and there was a lot of stuff that I felt didn't require its own title. Top of the list, X-Corp, which was just... I mean, this is a Batman show. I don't expect people to be familiar or fluent in current year X, but I mean, there were some concepts there that could barely fill a page, let alone a one-shot or a 5 or 6 issue miniseries. You know, X-Corp, top of the list, the Otherworld crap, the Limbo crap, Fallen Angels, the second volume of Marauders. I mean, there was just so much stuff there that would have been much better suited as an ongoing short subject in an anthology than being trotted out as a $5 book. And of course, I'm not a businessman. I have no stakes in the comics industry other than the fact that I don't want it to go away. But, it's been ages since I cracked the next book, so my references might be out of date. They probably are, but in my opinion, all throughout this era of X-Books, there was a need for something like an old-school X-Men Unlimited, where you could just put these side stories and put these character focuses and not drag it out over 100 pages. It's just not needed. And, like CJ said, they just don't have the legs for it. All in my opinion, of course, not gospel. Definitely, there is a place in comics for anthologies. And again, just like CJ said, things that can't carry their own title, things that are more experimental, new talent showcases. I love new talent showcases. You know, over on the blog, I did, the DC's new talent showcase. I love that kind of stuff. It's kind of offbeat. It's kind of fun. It's, it's interesting. It's different. And for an industry that touts being different and diverse in its offerings, it's really not. We know what comics are, at least mostly. It is what it is. But, anthologies, they can be cool. And even every now and again, I don't mind including a vital chapter in an ongoing narrative, in an anthology, in a quarterly, just to maybe get some new eyes on a probably higher-priced book that many non-completionists might decide to ignore. I mean, Batman Chronicles is a dollar more expensive than the rest of the Batman line. It's a quarterly, it's thicker, but in a way that makes it kind of disposable, and it also makes it easier to skip. You know, it makes it where it's like, if you've got your stack and there's a $3 book among the $2 books, and you have a decision to make, you're probably going to put the $3 book down. And I mean, talking about a $3 book as being expensive is pretty sobering, isn't it? Anyway, I do want to thank CJ so much for taking the time to write in and for facilitating a really fun discussion and a kind of a trip down memory lane for me. So thank you so much, CJ. I really, really appreciate it. And of course, if anybody else out there wants to write in, please feel free to. I could be reached all the different places. WeirdComicsHistory@gmail.com. You can leave a comment like CJ did at ChrisIsOnInfiniteEarths.com. Facebook, 90s X-Men, Twitter, X, Ace Comics. I've had that handle for 150 years now. I don't know why it split my mind. Anyway, I encourage and invite anybody who wants to chat to check in. But with all that having been said, I'd like to thank you all so much for sharing a little bit of your time with me today. Until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Makes it harder to think straight, start.